Yovanovitch's testimony explaining just how important the United States is to Ukraine.
Like my songs.
Wicked. My daughter wrote, but I never encouraged it.
Oh, nice.
I'm just going to be honest. I'm a parent. I didn't encourage it.
Yeah.
It's like my parents kid, did and didn't. Shot.
They're like, well, you probably want to make money, though. Right. So.
Yeah. Do you have a plan B? Do you have a plan B?
As long as you're happy.
Yeah. Oh, really? You say that?
No.
I don't believe that for a second. You're Jamaican. Have three jobs, and your music can be your fourth.
There you go. That's
okay, folks.
For Ukraine. A meeting with the President of the United States in the Oval Office is one of the most forceful diplomatic signals of support that the United States can send. Veteran diplomat George Kent testified to this.
New leaders, particularly countries that are trying to have good footing in the international arena, see a meeting with the U.S. President in the Oval Office at the White House as the ultimate sign of endorsement and support from the United States.
President Zelensky was a newly elected leader. He was swept into office on a pledge to end pervasive corruption. He also had a mandate to negotiate an end to the war with Russia. To achieve both goals, he needed strong U.S. support, particularly from President Trump, which Zelensky sought in the form of a White House meeting. David Holmes, political counselor to the embassy in Kyiv, described the particular importance of a White House visit to Ukraine in the context of its war with Russia.
It is important to understand that a White House visit was critical to President Zelensky. President Zelensky needed to show U.S. support at the highest levels in order to demonstrate to Russian President Putin that he had U.S. backing, as well as to advance his ambitious anti-corruption reform agenda at home.
In other words, Ukraine knew that Russia was watching carefully. That was particularly true in the spring of 2019. When Donald Trump launched the scheme at the center of the abuse of power charge. During this time period, Vladimir Putin was preparing for peace negotiations with the new Ukrainian leader. Putin could choose to escalate, or he could choose to de-escalate Russian aggression. And influencing his decision was an assessment of whether President Trump had Ukraine's back.
The Russians, as I said at my deposition, would love to see the humiliation of President Zelensky at the hands of the Americans.
An Oval Office meeting would have sent a strong signal of support that President Trump had Ukraine's back. The absence of such a meeting could be devastating. Indeed, Ukraine made very clear to the United States just how important a White House meeting between the two heads of state was for its fragile democracy. At the deposition, as the one on the screen reveals, of Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman, the director for Ukraine on the National Security Council, he recalled that following President Zelensky's inauguration, at every single meeting with Ukrainian officials, they asked their American counterparts about the status of an Oval Office meeting between the two presidents. Initially, the Ukrainians had reason to be optimistic that a White House meeting would be promptly scheduled. On April 21st, during President Zelensky's first call with President Trump, the new Ukrainian leader asked about a White House visit three times. As part of that brief congratulatory call, President Trump himself did extend an invitation. Ukraine's dependence on the United States and its desperate need for a White House meeting created an unequal power dynamic between the two presidents. As Lieutenant Colonel Vindman testified, it is that unequal power dynamic that turned any subsequent request for a favor from the president into a demand.
Now, Colonel, you've described this as a demand, this favor that the president asked. What is it about the relationship between the President of the United States and the President of Ukraine that leads you to conclude that when the President of the United States asks a favor like this, it's really a demand?
Chairman, the culture I come from, the military culture, when a senior asks you to do something, even if it's polite and pleasant, it's not to be taken as a request. It's to be taken as an order. In this case, the power disparity between the two leaders, my impression is that in order to get the White House meeting, President Zelensky would have to deliver these investigations.
Ambassador Gordon Sondland, Trump appointee, also acknowledged the importance of this power disparity and how it made President Zelensky eager to satisfy President Trump's wishes.
Holmes then said that he heard President Trump ask, quote, "Is he," meaning Zelensky, "going to do the investigation?" To which you replied, "He's going to do it." And then you added that President Zelensky will do anything that you, meaning President Trump, ask him to. Do you recall that?
I probably said something to that effect because I remember the meeting the president, or President Zelensky, was very solicitous is not a good word. He was just very willing to work with the United States and was being very amicable. And so putting it in Trump speak by saying he loves your ass, he'll do whatever you want, meant that he would really work with us on a whole host of issues.
He was not only willing, he was very eager, right?
That's fair.
Because Ukraine depends on the United States as its most significant ally. Isn't that correct?
One of its most, absolutely.
In other words, any request President Trump made to Ukraine would be difficult to refuse. So when President Trump asked Ukraine to investigate Joe Biden, as well as the wild conspiracy theory about the 2016 election, those were absolutely interpreted by President Zelensky and his staff as a demand. And that is where the White House meeting enters into the equation. When Ukraine did not immediately cave to Rudy Giuliani in the spring and announce the phony investigations, President Trump ratcheted up the pressure. As leverage, he chose the White House meeting he dangled during his April 21st call, precisely because President Trump knew how important the meeting was to Ukraine. Following their visit to Kyiv for the new Ukrainian leader's inauguration, Ambassador Sondland, Ambassador Volker, and Secretary Perry met with President Trump, and each of them encouraged the president to schedule the meeting. Here is what Ambassador Sondland had to say.
We advised the President of the strategic importance of Ukraine and the value of strengthening the relationship with President Zelensky. To support this reformer, we asked the White House for two things. First, a working phone call between Presidents Trump and Zelensky, and second, a working Oval Office visit. In our view, both were vital to cementing the U.S.-Ukraine relationship, demonstrating support for Ukraine in the face of Russian aggression, and advancing broader U.S. foreign policy interests.
So even though this meeting was critical to both Ukraine and America, President Trump ignored all of his policy advisors and expressed reluctance to meet with the new Ukrainian president. He refused to schedule an actual date. He claimed that Ukraine tried to take me down in 2016 and directed that the three U.S. officials, quote, talk to Rudy. And even though on May 29th, the president signed a letter reiterating his earlier invitation for President Zelensky to visit the White House, he still did not specify a date. But then President Trump went further. He met with Ukraine's adversary, Ukraine's enemy, our enemy. President Trump met with Russia. This didn't go unnoticed. Ukrainian officials became concerned when President Trump scheduled that face-to-face meeting with Vladimir Putin at the G20 summit in Japan on June 28th. Mr. Holmes testified on this particular point, and the troubling signal that meeting sent to our friend, to our ally, Ukraine.
Also on June 28th, while President Trump was still not moving forward on a meeting with President Zelensky, he met with Russian President Putin at the G20 summit in Osaka, Japan, sending a further signal of lack of support to Ukraine.
Now let's discuss how exactly President Trump used the withholding of the White House meeting to pressure Ukraine for his phony investigations, his quid pro quo scheme. It's important to understand that the pressure exerted on Ukraine by delaying the White House meeting didn't just occur right before the July 25th call. That pressure existed during the entire scheme, and it continues to this day. We know this from the efforts of administration officials to secure the meeting and from the Ukrainians continuously trying to lock down a date. For example, even after President Trump expressed reluctance about Ukraine on May 23rd, his administration officials continued working to secure a White House meeting. On July 10th, for instance, they raised it again when Mr. Yermak and Ukraine's national security advisor met with John Bolton at the White House.
And then we knew that the Ukrainians would have on their agenda, inevitably, the question about a meeting. And so as we get through the main discussion, we're going into that wrap-up phase. The Ukrainians, Mr. Danilyuk, starts to ask about a White House meeting, and Ambassador Bolton was trying to parry this back.
As you've seen, President Zelensky didn't just raise the Oval Office meeting on his April 21st call. He raised the meeting on July 21st, fifth call with President Trump again. President Zelensky said on the July 25th call, "I also wanted to thank you for your invitation to visit the United States, specifically Washington, D.C. After the July 25th call, the Ukrainians continued to press for the meeting, but that meeting never happened. Only on September 25th, after the House announced its investigation into the president's misconduct as it relates to Ukraine, and the existence of a whistleblower complaint became public, did President Trump and President Zelensky meet face to face for the first time? That meeting was on the sidelines of the UN General Assembly in New York. It was dominated by public release of the July 25th call record that had occurred the day before. It was a far cry from the strong demonstration of support that would have been achieved by an Oval Office meeting. Even President Zelensky recognized that a face-to-face talk on the sidelines of the United Nations General Assembly was not the same as an official Oval Office meeting. Sitting next to President Trump in New York, he again raised a White House meeting. Here is what President Zelensky said.
And I want to thank you for the invitation to Washington. Yeah. You invited me. But I think, I'm sorry, but I think you forgot to tell me the date. But I think in the near future.
President Trump was not just withholding a small thing. The Oval Office meeting was a big deal. Ukraine remains at war with Russia. It desperately needs our support. And as a result, the pressure on Ukraine not to upset President Trump, who still refuses to meet with President Zelensky in the Oval Office to this day, continues. David Holmes testified that the Ukrainian government wants an Oval Office meeting even after the release of the security assistance, and that our own United States national security objectives would also benefit from such a meeting.
Although the hold on the security assistance may have been lifted, there were still things they wanted that they weren't getting, including a meeting with the president in the Oval Office. Whether the hold, the security assistance hold continued or not, the Ukrainians understood that that's something the president wanted, and they still wanted important things from the president. So and I think that continues to this day. I think they're being very careful. They still need us now going forward. In fact, right now, President Zelensky is trying to arrange a summit meeting with President Putin in the coming weeks, to his first face-to-face meeting with him to try to advance the peace process. He needs our support. He needs President Putin to understand that America supports Zelensky at the highest levels. So this doesn't end with the lifting of the security assistance hold. Ukraine still needs us, and as I said, still fighting this war this very day.
Now, let's evaluate how exactly President Trump made clear to Ukraine that a White House meeting was conditioned on Ukraine announcing two phony political investigations that would help with President Trump's re-election in 2020, help him cheat and corrupt our democracy. By the end of May, it was clear that President Trump's pressure campaign to solicit foreign election interference wasn't working. President Zelensky had been elected and was rebuffing Mr. Giuliani's overtures. Even when President Trump directed his official staff to work with Mr. Giuliani in an effort to get President Zelensky to announce the two phony political investigations, that didn't work. So President Trump apparently realized that he had to increase the pressure. That's when he explicitly made clear to Ukraine that it would not get the desperately sought after Oval Office meeting unless President Zelensky publicly announced the phony investigations that President Trump sought. On July 2, 2019, Ambassador Volker personally communicated the need for investigations directly to President Zelensky during a meeting in Toronto.
After weeks of reassuring the Ukrainians that it was just a scheduling issue, I decided to tell President Zelensky that we had a problem with the information reaching President Trump from Mayor Giuliani. I did so in a bilateral meeting at a conference on Ukrainian economic reform in Toronto on July 2, 2019, where I led the U.S. delegation. I suggested that he call President Trump directly in order to renew their personal relationship and to assure President Trump that he was committed to investigating and fighting corruption, things on which President Zelensky had based his presidential campaign. I was convinced that getting the two presidents to talk with each other would overcome the negative perception of Ukraine that President Trump still harbored.
After Ambassador Volker instructed President Zelensky in Toronto on what to do, he updated Ambassador Taylor on his actions. He told Ambassador Taylor that he had counseled the Ukrainian president on how to, quote, prepare for the phone call with President Trump. He also told Ambassador Taylor that he advised Zelensky that President Trump would like to hear about the investigations. In addition to Ambassador Volker's direct outreach to President Zelensky, Ambassador Sondland continued to apply pressure as well. During two White House meetings that took place on July 10th with Ukrainian officials, the first meeting included National Security Advisor John Bolton, Dr. Fiona Hill, Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman, Secretary Rick Perry, Ambassador Volker, as well as Bolton's Ukrainian counterpart and Ukrainian presidential aide, Andriy Yermak. After a discussion on Ukraine's national security reform plans, Ambassador Sondland broached the subject of the phony political investigations. Fiona Hill, who attended the meeting, recalled that Ambassador Sondland blurted out the following in that meeting with the Ukrainians. Well, we have an agreement with the chief of staff for a meeting if these investigations in the energy sector start. That's code for Burisma, which is code for the Bidens. Ambassador Volker also recalled that Ambassador Sondland raised the issue of the 2016 election and Burisma investigations. Ambassador Volker found Ambassador Sondland's comments in that meeting to be inappropriate.
I participated in the July 10th meeting between National Security Advisor Bolton and then Ukrainian Chairman of the National Security and Defense Council, Alex Danilyuk. As I remember, the meeting was essentially over when Ambassador Sondland made a general comment about investigations. I think all of us thought it was inappropriate.
The exchange underscores that by early July, President Trump's demands for investigations had come to totally dominate almost every aspect of U.S. foreign policy toward Ukraine. Securing a Ukrainian commitment to do the investigations was a major priority of senior U.S. diplomats as directed by President Donald John Trump. The July 10th meetings also confirmed that the scheme to pressure Ukraine into opening investigations was not a rogue operation, but one blessed by senior administration officials at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. As Ambassador Sondland testified, everyone was in the loop. Mr. Majority Leader, based on your statement that we should break at around 6:30, I ask your indulgence. This may be a natural breaking point in connection with my presentation. Thank you.
Mr. Majority Leader?
I ask consent that we have a break for 30 minutes.
Without objection, so ordered.
Welcome, radio listeners. You're listening to Bound by Books Youth Radio on WGXC 90.7 FM, ACRA, Catskill, and Hudson, listener-supported radio for open ears. I'm Emily. I'm the director of the Hudson Area Library, and I'm from Hudson.
I'm Lena, and I go to school at MC Smith, and I'm also from Hudson.
I'm AJ. I'm 9. I go to school at Libri, and I'm from Manhattan / Queens.
Slash
Philadelphia.
No, up here.
Only for 2 days. And / Hudson. Actually / Elizaville, because we live in Elizaville. Yeah. Oh, yeah. So many slashes.
Lots of slashes. Yeah. And we have some special guests in the studio with us today. Can you all introduce them?
You want to go first?
No, you. So there is today chicken. And pig.
Do chicken and pig like reading books too?
Yes.
What do you think? That's a yes.
Wonderful.
Chicken said yes. He said, I love books, while he was introducing himself.
I'm not fluent in chicken.
I'm fluent in pig.
That's cool.
I'm also fluent in dog.
Whoa. But anyways, we're here every week talking about books.
So let's start.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Who wants to start talking about a book?
Pig.
No, I think Pig and Chicken are retired for the day.
Aww.
Maybe they'll say goodbye at the end of the show.
Yeah.
Because I think most of our listeners don't know how to speak Pig and Chicken, so they won't get as much out of the conversation.
Because all they're going to hear is oink, 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 quack, quack, oink, oink.
We could tell them what Pig and Chicken said.
What did they say?
I'm not fluent in pig, but Chicken said that my favorite book, my all-time favorite book, is Smile.
Oh, by Raina Telgemeier.
Yeah.
It's an excellent choice.
And Pig's favorite book was, I mean, I should say is, of course. Pig's favorite book is How to Speak Pig Latin.
Oh, Pig knows Pig.
Yeah,
Pig
Latin. I was recently reading it, and I can speak in Pig Latin.
Oh, yeah? Mm-hmm. Can you say something in Pig Latin to our listeners?
Emily, yay. yay. Erive. Eind K. Ute. E. May. Emily is very kind to me.
Aww. That's nice.
Yeah.
Was that you or the pig that said that?
Both of us.
Oh, that's nice. Thanks, guys. Anyway, so who has a book they want to talk about?
I guess I'll go first, and it wasn't by choice. I had to read it as homework, but these are just some weird books that my teacher made us read instead of Beat the Story Drum. So our teacher made us read this book called, like, Under the Sea Buddies or something like that. And they told us that, like, the shark protects, like, something. I forgot what the name was. Something protects the blind shrimp. And something cleans a fish. I forgot what they were called because it was my homework on Wednesday.
And you forgot it.
Yeah, and it's Monday.
But you learned that some underwater animals have...
Like, to protect
or
it.
Have a symbiotic relationship with another animal.
Yeah, so the question was, if you could rename the book, what would you rename it? And why would you name the book that? I named it, I forgot what I named it.
Just make up a name right
was
now.
It a better, was it a better name or a worse name?
It was a better name.
Okay.
It was like, what was it called? Underwater Buddies or something like that. All I know is that it had the word friends in it. But I said for why, it was because the predator protects the prey and the prey protects the predator kind of because they most of them clean them and then the bacteria will come off of them, so will the parasites. And if they do, well, they weren't all predators, but like they just mostly cleaned them for, like, the water buddies, or they helped them. And if they didn't have that water buddy, then they would die.
No! But also, yay! Because they got that buddy. Can I tell you about a book that I read that's related to that? Yay. I wasn't going to talk about it, but I just happened to read a book this week that was a picture book called Friends Stick Together by Hannah E. Harrison, who does really cute picture books. I love her illustrations. And this one was about the symbiotic relationship between Rupert, who is a rhino, and Levi, who is a tick bird. And tick birds, guess what they do for rhinos?
Eat ticks?
They eat ticks off them.
Yeah.
The rhinos get ticks, and so they don't want to be all itchy, so the birds eat the ticks. And then the ticks are like, yay, food. But it's a picture book that's not, you know, it's not a science book.
The ticks or the tick birds?
Both are happy.
What?
Well, the ticks aren't happy.
Because they're going to get eaten. But.
Although maybe, I don't know if ticks actually have feelings.
Yeah. And then a second book was about, like, it kind of relates to me, but it was about, like, this boy who thought that cleaning and chores, like, inside of the house is woman's work, which it actually isn't. Boo! And he goes to visit his grandpa, and so his grandpa does... quote unquote what this boy thinks woman's work, but his grandpa was saying a really good example, and he was happy he was with his grandpa because he's kind of a cowboy. And he thinks that's like cool. Being outside of the house and doing what his grandpa is doing is men's work.
What's the name of this book?
I forgot. Also,
we're gonna call it Grandpa is a Cowboy and Cleans the House Too.
Yeah.
That's a good title, right?
Yeah.
Which of the two books did you like the most?
I liked the Grandpa is a Cowboy and also Cleans the House.
I like that, Grandpa.
What was the ending of the story? Because I think I might actually know the name. I just need confirming.
They didn't spoiler give us alert. The ending of the story because...
But what was the beginning?
It was like, oh, what's his face thinks, like, explains how he thinks that cleaning the house is woman's work, and like when he goes out with his father, his grandpa changes his mind about like cleaning is for women. Oh, what's the book called? I think
it is Justin and the Best Biscuits in the World or something.
Oh yeah,
like
it
that.
Is Justin and the Best Biscuits in the World. Because
I read that.
I like
one,
my
like,
title better one, personally.
Yeah. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, maybe more than that times, because in my old school that was like one of the best books in the bookshelf. P.S. I read the whole entire bookshelf.
Nice. What? Oh my god.
That's
and
cool.
It was like a huge bookshelf. I read them all, and that one was one of the most fun ones.
When you said, like, you read all the books on the bookshelf, it reminded me of last year, how Miss Velez, who is my favorite teacher who had to move away, like, my favorite teacher ever, but, like, Miss Hanley is also good, like, Miss Velez, but Miss Velez was really nice, and how you read the entire bookshelf, it kind of made me think how I mentioned this to Emily, but I got an award from my teacher, and it was that I was like the book kid who liked bookish things. Yeah.
I could imagine getting that award too.
I love books.
We'd probably get the same award.
They should have that award at my school. So mad.
Well, it was only just the teacher who awarded me. I only got, like, an award 2 times in my grade ever, but it could be more than 2. Because it could be this year, next year, next year, next year, and so on and so forth.
I like the idea of reading all the books on a shelf, but I feel like inevitably I would get to a handful of books that I just really didn't want to read. And I'd be like, should I do it just so that I can say I read the whole shelf? Or should I save myself the pain of reading these books that seem awful?
Yeah, I actually had like half of the bookshelf for those books, but I read them and they turned out to be pretty good except for one.
So they surprised you.
Except for one, which is the worst book ever. No, I'm just joking.
But do you have a book you want to talk about today, AJ?
Maybe.
Maybe. Have you been reading anything this week? Are you still working on your facts book?
I didn't get to go to the library. But there was this one book that I read at Libri. It was called The Last Concert. And it was about a boy who was in a music class. And he flung a rubber band at his teacher's head. And it hit his brain. And then, well, not his brain, but the area where his brain is, like, right in the middle of his forehead, and then that changed the teacher, and then when they were going to have the concert, the teacher actually let the boy be in charge of the concert, and then they pulled it off at the end, but I won't tell you what happened in the middle, because that will give away the end.
Was it a good book?
Yes.
Yeah, you enjoyed it?
Yes.
And that was one you found at your school?
Mm-hmm.
AJ's trying to reach for my books.
I want to read them right now.
Maybe you could read the description.
Ooh.
Do you want to read the description
can
for me?
I see if there are any pictures?
Well, here. I'm going to have AJ and Lena read the descriptions for the books that I read this past week. Who wants to go first? Okay, AJ is going to read first. So this is Cub by Cynthia L. Copeland.
Breaking news! Junior High is a jungle! Evie, Leah, and Tammy, the predators, rule the 7th grade hallway at Litchfield Junior High. Studious and slightly dorky, Cindy and her friends are the prey. Cindy's defense is to play dead, pretending to be boring so the mean kids lose interest and leave her alone. Then everything changes when Cindy gets an internship as a Cub reporter for the local newspaper. Suddenly, she's chasing down breaking news with the bold young female journalist. Cindy doesn't always get it right, whether she's reporting on town meetings or ghost hunters, falling off her bicycle into her first crush, or figuring out new friendships. But over the course of an exciting year, she learns how to dig for the truth and write a great news story, and she sees how brave journalism can change a neighborhood or a nation.
Mm-hmm. So that's a graphic novel memoir by Cynthia L. Copeland. And it's really good. It's set in the 70s. So that's when she grew up.
Yay.
So that's interesting fashion. And
it's a comic book. Yay.
She loves writing and she loves art. And so she finds that she's really excited about journalism. So her English teacher, her favorite teacher, sets her up with a female newspaper reporter who like brings her along and shows her the ropes and teaches her how to be a journalist. And she starts getting into photography. And then there's all these friendship things happening, as it noted at the beginning, where there's like the quote-unquote predators of the school, these three girls that are not very nice. And then her best friend Katie starts hanging out with them.
Uh-oh.
So she kind of has to figure out how to deal with that. And it's a really nice book. I liked it a lot. Yay. I liked the journalism aspect. I thought that was really fun. You get to read some of her articles, and it has like the notes that her mentor puts on the article. You know, her little edits.
Right now I'm just reading the first few pages, and it looks like a very, very good book.
Yeah.
Can I borrow it? Please.
Well, it's a library book, so I'd have to check it out.
What time do you return it? What day do you return
it? We'll figure it out after the show. We'll make sure you get this book.
And then you're just over here. You take out the scanner out of your bag. Okay, bloop. Here. Beep. Now you have to return it like 3 Mondays later.
Yeah. Yeah. That was fun. Mm-hmm. I didn't grow up in the 70s, but I grew up in the 80s.
Oh, that's when my mom grew up in Mexico.
Oh, cool. I was in New Hampshire.
Oh.
But it's interesting reading these graphic novel memoirs like this one and the ones by Raina Telgemeier. Like our friend Chicken really likes Smile.
Yeah.
By Raina Telgemeier. Because they're set in this time period that where technology was very different. And so things like cell phones don't factor into the day-to-day life. It's very interesting.
Yeah.
But yeah, that was a fun book. I highly suggest it. And it, like you were talking about with that story about the cowboy grandpa and stuff.
Yeah.
About how this, there was this idea of like women's work. There's a little bit of that in this story too.
No.
But in a good way.
Okay. If it's in a bad way, then I want to not like have that in the book.
No, I think it's subtly in there, but it's done in a very good way.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay, so.
So what's the other book that I read this week?
Okay, the other book is called The Okay Witch by Emma Steinkeller. And it says, magic is harder than it looks. 13-year-old Moth Hush loves all things witchy, but she's about to discover that witches aren't just stuff of movies, books, and spooky stories. When some bullies try to ruin her Halloween, something really strange happens. Founder Bluff,
Massachusetts. I get stuck on words like that
sometimes. Has a century-old history of witch drama and Moth's family is at the center of it all. When Moth's new powers show up, things get totally out of control. She meets a talking cat, falls into an enchanted diary, and unlocks hidden witch world. Secrets surface from generations past as Moth unravels the complicated legacy at the heart of her town, her family, and herself in this spellbinding graphic novel debut. Emma Steinkeller spins a story packed with humor, heart about the weird and wonderful adventures of Witch in Progress. And also, I cannot English today. English well.
But you were able to translate very fluently, Chicken.
Yes.
So that's impressive.
Yeah, but I can't English my reading.
That's okay. But yeah, I liked that one a lot too. Obviously, it's not a memoir.
Yeah.
Since there's witchcraft and magic and stuff. Although maybe that could be in a memoir. I don't know.
What's a memoir again?
A memoir is somebody's autobiography, their memories of their childhood.
Like Smile and El Defo?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
El Defo is one of my favorite autobiographies.
Oh, yeah? Yay.
She also draws all the characters as buddies.
Oh. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that one's really good. Maybe you should talk about it on the show sometime.
Speaking of the OK Witch, while I was waiting for my name to be called while I was at my orthodontist, like, my braces didn't get tightened, but, like, they're just cleaning my teeth.
It's good to do.
And so there was a show on called The Owl House, and it's about this girl named Luz, I think you're supposed to pronounce it. And she wants to become a witch in training, and she's helped by this witch and a ferocious demon that's said in the ads, because, like, it literally says that if you see the Owl House, because, like, they've been specifically trying to get me for those ads.
I've never heard of that show.
Probably because it's on Disney Plus.
Okay. And that would be it. I don't have Disney Plus yet. I may someday. Okay. No promises.
Okay.
Great. So yeah, so those are two books that I really enjoyed that I read this week. They're very different. Not sure if I have a favorite. Maybe Cub.
Yeah, Cub's
awesome. I
think
I liked Cub more, but I really like graphic novel memoirs a lot.
I love Cub.
And I think I liked the art style a bit more. I liked the art on the OK Witch, but the one thing that bothered me is all of the characters have these, like, darker noses, and it distracted me.
Actually, it has that on the cover.
They all have these little dark noses, all the characters.
Wait, can
I
see?
Every once in a while, I'd be like, why are their noses so dark?
Wait, let me see.
Look at the green nose. The person has a green
nose. Oh, my God. Oh, you're right. Maybe it's just their art style.
Yeah.
Or they just wanted to make it look
weird. I assume it's just their art style, but I guess it's not. It was distracting for me. But I still enjoyed the story.
Yeah.
I like a good witch story, or an okay witch story, because it's called The Okay Witch. Anyway,
the first thing in the book, it says, chapter one, something wicked this way comes. Mm-hmm. Okay, there.
Do you know Something Wicked This Way Comes?
No.
It's a name of a short novel by Ray Bradbury about like an evil circus that comes to town. Plus, it just sounds really cool. Something Wicked This Way Comes. See, you can English. If you could say that, you can English.
Say it again.
What? Something Wicked This Way Comes? I'm not sure which part you meant.
This is my evil laugh.
I could.
This is how chicken says it. That's terrifying.
Oh my God.
I know. I keep practicing on my little sister.
So I have a question, since you both seem to be very into comics, since you've both just started reading the books that I brought with me today. Do you have a favorite graphic novel of all times?
Ooh.
El Defo.
We had to choose one. El Defo. Mm-hmm.
I'd have
this is my,
by C.C. Bell.
This is going to be my second one.
I'd have to say... Wait, does it have to be a graphic novel?
Yeah.
Okay,
or it could be manga or comics or whatever. It doesn't have to be.
Ghost.
Ghost by Rena Telgemeier?
Yeah, but...
I still have to read that one.
But my favorite book...
Did you read Guts?
Oh, I have that book. I actually, like, own it.
Did you read it? Maybe Lena should try to finish it so we can all talk about it next show.
Yeah.
I believe in you. You can do it.
But I'm trying to look for, remember my red book that I brought on the show a couple of times? It's the one where it holds the flea, the facility, and the prom dress comic.
Oh, I don't remember ever seeing it. I remember you talking about it, but I've never seen it.
Oh, okay. Even though I've shown it on the show and
I never saw it. I've never seen your art.
Yeah,
you need to show me sometime.
Yeah, but I mean, like, have you seen, like, the outside of it?
No, I didn't. I guess I didn't notice.
Oh,
because I didn't see the inside, so it just probably looked like a regular book to me.
Okay, so Well, I lost it at school.
No.
But probably my violin teacher took it because she goes up to the room whenever.
Yeah, you should try to find it because I want to see it.
Maybe
check the lost and found too, like in the office.
Yeah.
It's a good spot.
But since my name is on it, on multiple things of it, I am only one because, and my name is so small that you probably can't even read it. But I hope they return it to me.
That'd be nice. If you're listening to this and you find this book, bring it on down to the school office or to WGXC or to the library.
Yeah.
To Emily at the library.
Yeah, to
Emily. Don't give it to anyone else.
Yeah.
Just give it to me.
Okay, so, and if you don't know who Emily is,
she's going
to be in the office.
Or
in the library.
Or at home.
Yeah.
Or running errands or at a meeting. Anyways, don't find me. We're small staff. Yeah.
Okay, and I'll describe her. She wears a lot of blue. She has brown hair. She has green eyes. And she's beautiful.
I have green eyes?
Yeah.
They're blue.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I see green from here since it's really dark.
Cool.
I have emerald eyes.
But anyways, we're out of time for today.
Yeah.
Already?
Aw.
I know, it goes fast.
It's like... Zoop.
And scene.
Yeah.
But we hope everyone has a good week with lots of quality reading time. Thank you to our guest, Pig and Chicken, for joining us in the studio today. It's always good to hear from you.
Yeah.
That chicken just sounds wrong.
Yeah, and here is Pig's...
It's creepy.
That was chicken's.
Hope everyone has a good week. Happy reading.
Yeah.
Bye.
Bye.
Clima quente, meu amor. E é só você me chamar que eu vou. Mandei lamber, te languzar. Fazer festa, te fazer suar. Se aqui na pista tá demais, imagine sem roupa e sem tua paz. Despertar sentidos, meu lado feroz. Coisas que podemos só fazer a sós. Tá chegando a hora de você me devorar. A noite inteira, frente e verso, sem pressa de acabar. Tá chegando a hora de você me devorar. A noite inteira, frente e verso, sem pressa de acabar. Amor, e é só você me chamar que eu vou. Mandei lamber, te languzar. Fazer festa, te fazer suar. Se aqui na pista tá demais, imagine sem roupa e sem tua paz. Despertar sentidos, meu lado feroz. Coisas que podemos só fazer a sós. I'm
Next, we have an interview from
WOOC.
To learn more about this program, the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org.
This is Dave Pablo. I'm in the studio with Katie Vesio of Mega Energy. And what we're going to talk about today is community choice aggregation. So for people who've never heard of that, what is it about?
Community choice aggregation, or CCA, it's a bulk electricity buying program, and it focuses on residents and eligible small businesses. So CCA uses a model of group purchasing to harness the buying power of a lot of residents, pooling together to get a better price for electricity, offer residents price stability and budget certainty, and providing access to renewable electricity. All of those are possible through community choice aggregation. And what it really does is, you know, for example, in Troy, we're sitting in Troy, eligible residents within the city pool together with eligible residents in all of the communities that are participating. We have 14 in the capital region, and kind of really harness that collective buying power of, you know, 90,000 households potentially.
Mm-hmm. So for a person who is just used to getting their power from wherever they get their power from, mm-hmm. and paying their bill, how will this affect them?
So everyone's, you know, a customer of the utility, and the utility company maintains the infrastructure that delivers your electricity. And most people also buy their supply from their utility company, which after deregulation in the late 90s, the state said, you don't have to do that anymore. You can go and purchase from a third-party supplier. So that's been in effect for a long time now. What CCA does is help residents and small businesses shop for that third-party supplier by doing it as a team, as an aggregation. And so, you know, you still remain a customer of the utility. They still deliver your electrons to your home. But we're talking about shopping for the supply portion of your bill, so those number of kilowatt hours you use each month in your home or small business.
So I think a lot of us will get things in the mail from time to time saying, you know, you could get your energy from this renewable company or that renewable company. Mm-hmm. And as a consumer, I think it's really hard for people to figure out, you know, is this a good thing? Is this a bad thing? Am I getting a better deal? Am I getting what they say? Is your service a lot like having someone kind of screen those things for you and
absolutely
look for the best deal?
That's a great way to put it. So, you know, individually, I can go out on the marketplace and, you know, answer a telemarketing call or call the number on a flyer I might get in the mail to inquire about prices from a third-party supplier. But what community choice aggregation does is, you know, my organization, Mega, acts as an administrator. And so we can go out and say, these are the terms and conditions we want for all of these residents. We want them to have flexibility to leave the program if they want. We want them to get a competitive rate. And it really kind of screens out those bad players in the marketplace that may have predatory practices that get some residents into unfavorable situations with their electricity purchases. So, you know, that's another benefit of community choice aggregation is you have someone out there working for you, negotiating those contract terms and deals. And also, you're not just shopping for yourself. They're going out to the marketplace saying, supply electricity for all of these residents. And so we can command a better price in the marketplace.
And what is Mega Energy's orientation like? Where did you guys start, and are you a for-profit company, or how did you come into being?
Mega stands for the Municipal Electric and Gas Alliance. Mega was started in the late 90s as a bi-county partnership between Tompkins and Tioga counties. They got together and were trying to create a program for themselves in order to contain electricity costs and natural gas costs for local governments, right? So that grew over time. Their collective buying power of pooling together the energy used by those two counties grew into a multi-county program, and now they serve over 30 counties, hundreds of cities, towns, villages, small not-for-profits even. Mega is a not-for-profit local development corporation. The founder, who's a former Tompkins County legislator, lives in the Albany area, and Mega was created for local governments by local governments. That mission is still true with this new program called Community Choice Aggregation. This extends the ability of local governments to offer